So let's get started then. So just on the very left here, I put just some of these acronyms that we've started introducing in this course because I find that it can get a little confusing if you're not used to those. So machine learning, you're going to see that a lot, ML. And then last time we talked about two specific types of machine learning, supervised learning, unsupervised. Today's going to be all about supervised, but we're going to throughout the course use UL to mean unsupervised learning. And this one's important. NN is neural network. So today we're actually not going to talk about neural networks, but we are from time to time going to talk about something where a model has nearest neighbors, or even an algorithm called K nearest neighbors. So I'm going to make sure I'm pretty careful to distinguish that from neural network. So if you see just NN by itself, I'm always going to mean neural network. And for this algorithm, I might abbreviate it as KNN, but there'll always be that K in the front. So anyway, I'll try to remind you about that so it's not confusing. So the outline for today, we're going to start by looking at one more example of supervised learning to kind of add to the examples we were looking at in Monday's lecture. And this is the example we're going to explore in the tutorial today. Then we're going to look at our first supervised learning algorithm, which is linear regression. And that's also what we're going to look at in the tutorial. Then we're going to talk about an algorithm that can be used within many other algorithms called gradient descent. And if we have time, we'll start talking about another supervised learning algorithm called k-nearest neighbors. It's actually a pretty fundamental or simple algorithm, and lots of times you would actually even talk about this before even talking about linear regression. I'm just putting it at the end of the lecture because linear regression is more important to the tutorial, but just note that pedagogically in other courses you might often see this one covered first. And then these are just some useful references that are going to give you a bit more detail on the contents of today. And I'm going to make a document on the portal of references that this one, for example, we'll revisit a lot in the course, specifically today, section 6. You guys have any questions? So let me just remind you about what it means to do supervised learning. So we have a data set that's composed of these pairs, X and Y. X are called the data points. And Y are called labels. And what we're trying to do with this data set is use information from this data set to do some kind of a fit of some function f of x to the labels y. And the type of function we fit to is going to depend on the specific type of supervised learning algorithm that we're looking at. But these are kind of some features that are common to all of them. So let's go to talking about the first item on this outline, which is how we could set up supervised learning to tell us something about a Hamiltonian, and specifically for us, an Ising Hamiltonian. Okay, so just to remind you, the Hamiltonian for an icing model, we know that we sum over all of our nearest neighbors and consider some products of spin variables. My spin variables, I'm going to store them as plus or minus one. I think actually, I think I wrote this on Monday. On Monday, I wrote one or zero. It doesn't matter. You can do it either way. But I'm writing plus or minus one now, which might be different just because in the tutorial, that's the way that we're going to store it. So I just wanted to write it like that. So again, there's nothing wrong with what I wrote last time. You can store it either way, but we'll do it like this for today. And again, this means summing over nearest neighbors. So then we could consider different data sets related to this model, but we're going to specifically consider the following. So let's consider our data point for each of these pairs to be just the spin configuration, S1 up to Sn, where n is just the total number of spins that I'm looking at. And then my label is going to be the energy. So what we're going to consider in tutorial is a case in one dimensions where we generate a data set like this, but then we're going to kind of consider the data generation quite separately from the algorithm that we use. And so then we're going to assume that someone gives us this data set, but we don't know where it came from. So even though we do, I'm just telling you it was generated from here. In tutorial, we're going to consider a problem where someone hands us this data set and we have to see if we can extract information about it. So what we could do in this case, we could assume a more general model and then see if from that more general model, our algorithm can recover what we know to be the features of the data. Okay, so what we would do in this case is we would define some more general model. This is just one example of a more general model we could do, and this is the one we're going to use in tutorial. So maybe we could assume that we're expecting some kind of pairwise interactions between the spins, but we're not going to assume that they interact with just a nearest neighbor coupling. There could be some coupling between any two spins. Then the idea would be to see if we could use supervised learning to fit our data set, determine these J's, and then check if they match with the data that we know it came from. So this is what we're going to look at in tutorial today. And you could assume kind of extent, you could also imagine extending this problem to some other related models or data sets that you might have. You guys have questions at all about this setup? We're going to make it more explicit and clear in the tutorial. So there's a few more steps, of course, of exactly how everything works. And that's why we're going to kind of explore it in more detail this afternoon. Okay, so this is kind of an example of a problem in physics we could study. Now let's talk about a type of algorithm. We're going to look at linear regression. We can use this for a whole wide range of different problems, of course, not just this one. Oh, I forgot to note this, that I actually put my lecture notes online already, just in case any of you want to be following along during the lecture. So I'll try to do that in general before the lectures. So the first line that I've written is just the same as what I've been writing every time for supervised learning, essentially. We're trying to fit some function to represent our data set, but in this case, we're going to finally see an example of what this function might look like. And it's some function that's linear in my data points x. So for every component, I'm going to multiply by some parameter w. And these are the parameters that I'm going to try to determine in my algorithm. So for every component of x, I'm going to have some parameter that I'm going to try to fit. One thing I'll note here, you might notice that in the past I was saying y could be a vector, and here it's just a scalar. You can extend this method to be for a vector y. It's just that you would kind of just repeat the same procedure for every component of y. So it's just kind of like adding another dimension to the matrices in this case. So I'm just writing it in terms of a scalar y, and that's what most references will do. So I just wanted to be consistent with most references you might look up. But of course, you can just easily generalize this to add another dimension and consider a vector here as well. This is the way we'll use it in tutorial anyway. So to do this, we have to make sure we consider our whole data set. So far, I've been kind of introducing these subscripts to introduce component to talk about components. But we're going to need some new notation to talk about how we consider all elements of the data set. So let me show you that. So in addition to the dimension of x, I also have to know the number of data points that I have. And I'm going to introduce a superscript to tell you which sample, to index which sample I'm talking about. So out of all these samples, I could look at sample I and then index over the component. Just to make sure this part is clear. As before, this J subscript goes over the components of X. And then this new one is going over the samples. And then now I'm going to talk about Y as a vector, but it's going to mean something a little bit different than before. It's going to mean the components of this vector are going to be the different samples, but each of them is a scalar. So for every data point in my data set, I have some scalar label in this case. Let me actually just write a note here. So the dimension of my label is 1, but now I'm introducing a vector to indicate the value for every sample. Does that make sense? Yeah, OK. Maybe I was worried it would be confusing, so I'm repeating it a lot. But.
So you're just kind of viewing the whole data set as a big array.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, perfect. Exactly. We're going to actually make that more explicit in a minute, too. Oh, actually, yeah. It's so good you said that because I just realized I missed a line in my notes. I was like, where is that exact thing you just said? And I just skipped over it. So we're going to exactly store this in a matrix, capital X. So just as you said, I'm going to put these into one big matrix, one dimension for the samples and one for the components. And just to remind you, those W parameters are what we want to try to determine in our algorithm. So the way I'm going to kind of formulate this is by introducing some function that we want to minimize and the function that we're going to consider. It's going to come from kind of looking at the output that I get for every data point when I have the parameter set to some value and comparing it with the label that I wanted to get, and then kind of summing that difference over all the data sets. So I would want that to be very small. If I was perfectly reproducing the labels, then applying this function would always give me back my label that I expect, and this would just be 0. But it might not be possible to actually have it be 0. And if I want to write this in matrix notation, I can write that in terms of this like normal, this norm of this vector function here. And let me just clarify what this 2 means, and that just in case, this is kind of some notation that we're going to use throughout this course. This is just, I mean, it's something you will have seen before, just the normal distance of a, or the normal length of a vector. Just in case you haven't seen, we're going to call this an L2 norm. And sometimes we might explore different types of norms that we could use. Today, we're just going to look at this L2 norm, but you could look at different ways of measuring this distance. Okay, so linear regression is actually a pretty special and unique compared to other algorithms that we're going to study in this course, especially compared to neural networks, in the sense that we can actually exactly solve this equation. So if I minimize this function by varying these parameters w, you can show that this is the solution. So I have to apply some operations to this big X matrix that I've defined, and also consider my label. So this turns out to be the solution, which you can show if you want to. And then to get the corresponding prediction from this algorithm, I just have to then go back to my original formula here for how f of x is calculated for a given w. So just one thing to make sure we're aware of is that we're doing matrix inversion, but we could in principle be having a matrix XTX that's not invertible. So that's something to be cautious of. So we have to make sure that we would be applying this or studying this only in cases where that matrix is invertible. Often in typical data sets, this could become a problem in cases where you don't have enough samples, for example. So this is, again, something we're going to explore in tutorial when we have to be careful about that.
Lauren?
Yeah.
Why didn't inverse x itself at the beginning, right? Because I could inverse x.
X. Here?
Yeah, like
why not do like?
Like omega can be x inverse y, right? There is also a chance that x is not invertible, but.
Wait.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, I think I was the same as you when I was preparing this, I was also thinking like, this seems like overkill. I think I have a better solution to linear regression. Yeah, you have to be careful with your minimizing. Okay. Any other questions?
Seems like X will be, depending on the data, it will be too big a matrix, and I think matrix inversion is computational intensive.
That's exactly what, yeah, you guys are just always predicting the next thing to say. Yeah, that's a really good point. So let me now say, even though this setup or this linear regression has an exact solution, we could also use other ways to find W that are actually a bit more general. So we can often use this exact solution, but there could be cases where we would actually prefer to use another algorithm that I'm going to talk about that's called gradient descent. And one reason, it's exactly what you said. So as your data set becomes bigger, or as your X data points have many components, it can be very inefficient to invert this matrix. And so looking at a different type of algorithm can be a better option. The second point is not necessarily a reason to look at gradient descent now specifically, but it's just to let you know it's going to be useful for lots of the algorithms that we study, kind of a more general algorithm that you can use for parameter optimization, whereas this solution is, of course, very specific to the gradient descent. So I'm just now going to talk about gradient descent just slightly more generally than here. So rather in this problem that I showed you before, these parameters have the same dimension as the dimension of these data points. But in general, you could have another function you're trying to minimize that depends on a different number of parameters. So I'm just going to say that the number of parameters is n rather than dx. Thank you. So of course we want to try to find some solution so that the partial derivative of this function I'm trying to minimize with respect to all the parameters is zero.
Before we go ahead, in linear regression, only when like x is equal to dx, that will give a unique solution. Then if the number of equations are less, it will give infinite many solutions. But it
I guess like from the very beginning, I've kind of imposed that, like even back here, right? The number of parameters that I'm fitting to is the same as dx. Like there's one for every dx. It's all just going back to the definition of the setup. I'm just saying, you know, we're going to use this more generally for other f of x where w might not enter in this same way. So I'm just saying, you know, I didn't want you, like later on you might refer to these notes for a different algorithm, and I didn't want you to get confused that the number of parameters is dx, because it's not in general. Okay. So let me just imagine that I can look at kind of the functional dependence of this this L with respect to just one of these parameters. This is not something that we can directly access easily all the time, but just imagine we can do this just to kind of understand what we want to do, or at least the goal. We eventually want to find the value of each parameter so that this L would be minimized. And we're going to kind of start with no knowledge of where that should be. So we're going to have some random starting point, and the idea is just to take steps such that we kind of improve our solution and hopefully eventually find a good minimum. So let me assume that I'm going to take a pretty small change in this function so that I can approximate it in terms of the corresponding change in each parameter. And of course, depending where I am, this may or may not be okay. So we have to be careful with how we do that. And I'm just defining kind of the notation that I'm using here. So just remember that these parameters w are our fitting parameters. So we can explore values of them that are anything we want and then see if it's a good representation of our data set. So there's no, that we don't have to solve exactly a formula in order to figure out how we want to adjust those. But we know that our goal is kind of to update parameters such that this L function is going to decrease. So one option is that we could update with something that's proportional to this value. And this means that for every parameter, I'm going to update each one by looking at the partial derivative of L with respect to that parameter. And this is gradient descent. This is a general expression for gradient descent. Now, I want to talk about this eta. I'm going to do that on the next board, just to make sure you guys can see. Okay, so in this expression, these last two boxes, you'll see there's some eta introduced there that I haven't talked about. This basically controls how big of a step I'm going to take in proportionally to this gradient that I'm looking at. So within gradient descent, again, I can explore parameters however I want to. So that means I can choose this learning rate however I want to in principle. Of course, some choices are going to be better than others. So this is actually our first example of something called a hyperparameter. Which means kind of a parameter of our optimization algorithm. It's going to kind of affect how well we find a minimum, or it's kind of a property of the algorithm itself, not a property of the data, and we can explore different values of that. With this way of choosing these parameters, what would these W? The change in this L function is going to be this expression here, which you can see as long as my learning rate is positive. And if my approximation is valid, of course, like this might not always be a good approximation, but this expression here is always going to be less than zero. Whether delta L is actually less than zero kind of depends on how good of an approximation it is, but if it is a good approximation, then we will take a step that decreases L. Any questions? So let's talk about this learning rate parameter a little bit. Does anyone have any thoughts on kind of trouble we could get into if we're not careful with the value that we choose for this like step size or this learning rate?
Oscillate around minimum.
Sorry?
Oscillating around minimum.
Right, exactly. So especially, if your step size is too big, then you could imagine that you could overshoot the minimum. You just might not find it for sure. Yeah. And basically, that's also kind of a side effect of the fact, I guess, the fact that this approximation, or this one, I guess, specifically, is just not going to be valid if I take a huge step, right? So when I'm getting close to the minimum, I usually want to take a pretty, small step? Depending on, obviously, it depends on the gradient, but yeah, we have to be careful. So exactly as you were saying, if we take too big of a step, we could miss the minimum. We could actually end up getting a solution where this L function increases by following this update. What about if it's too small? Any ideas?
I was thinking that one might be trusting a local minimum, not the global.
For sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. Another thing to be aware of kind of practically, so let me first say, that's a really good point. So okay, so I think there's kind of two, let me just say that if you take a small enough step size, you can guarantee that you'll eventually converge to some local minimum. There's kind of two important things to be aware of here. What you were saying is it might just be a local minimum. So we can get stuck in a local minimum. There could be cases where this local minimum solution might still be a pretty good solution. In lots of cases of data, I might not actually know if I'm finding the very best global minimum, but sometimes some of these local minima I might find might be okay. But definitely, we probably want to have some element of exploring different possible solutions within our algorithm, so we have to be careful there. Another thing is kind of this word eventually. So we're kind of used to the idea that, you know, mathematically maybe this is good to find a local minimum eventually, but you know, we're trying to do something on our laptop. We maybe want to get some results within a couple hours or something like that. Maybe it's actually going to take, maybe eventually for some problems is going to mean, you know, a year or something like that. You know, that could be a problem. So we have to kind of practically consider the resources we have too. And if we make this learning rate too small, could take a very long time.
Maybe one question. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking that delta L, the way we have defined, will always be negative, right?
The L or?
The delta L means you start from some point, and the way we have chosen our delta omega or delta W is such that delta L is minus eta.
Well, it's only that way if this kind of approximation is valid. So if it's actually okay to say that a small change in delta L is proportional to a small change in the parameter. So you could imagine that let me try to find a counterexample. So, you know, here, you know, I'm going to calculate my derivative here, and then I'm going to take a step in W. I could take a small step. If I take too big of a step, I'm going to overshoot this minimum, or I could, I'm not coming up with a good example where I'm showing you that it increases. Let me see if I can find a spot where that will go. Okay, let me look here. So, here, this is my kind of derivative of this function at this point. So the idea would be to take a small step proportional to this. So what I'd probably want to do is kind of go off in this direction and maybe end up here or somewhere close to here, right? But imagine I take a very big step, I could end up like way over here, right?
Yeah, maybe what I want to know is when does this stop? How do
we? Sorry, say again?
Because this is like iteratively you do things, right? Every step you change delta W, check.
Yeah.
So when do we stop?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I guess this is something that we have to talk about a lot more generally to really see. What we're going to be doing is kind of plotting behavior of this. So, you know, right now we're plotting this as a function of W. We could also plot this as a function of step size and kind of watch it decrease. Sometimes in your data, you're going to kind of see a point where it's basically converging to a stable value. It's not really getting any new information. That can mean it's stuck, though. So it's actually a pretty complicated problem to know when you're done, when you actually have found a really good solution, because lots of times you can't actually prove that you've found a global minimum. But again, this, I guess, this is something exact in gradient descent because we're choosing it to be this. And so I agree that this thing is always negative, but whether this thing is actually a good approximation of this is not always true, right? Other questions there?
Could you give examples of different choices?
Different choices of?
The parameter change.
So what do you mean there? So basically what we're going to play around with today, there's more sophisticated algorithms that aren't contained in what I showed here, but within this framework, all you can really vary, all that we're going to really play with varying is this value of eta. And you can also vary it as a function of time. So often you'll initially take very big steps because you really have you're likely not anywhere close to a local minimum. But eventually you likely want to start taking smaller steps. So that's the biggest way to change within the gradient descent framework.
But are there other choices within, like, is this now the full definition of gradient descent, or are there like other functional forms, let's say?
So this is the way you would always update your parameters if you're using gradient descent. But we can use in different time. We're going to, in later lectures, talk about other optimization algorithms that are more sophisticated than gradient descent. But if it's gradient descent, it's always this.
Yeah, just because this is what you typically see with this hyperparameter, but I just want to make sure when you say we are free to choose delta W, that
I see.
Freedom really lies in the eta.
Sorry, yeah, I see what you mean. I don't mean like within gradient descent you can choose anything. I just mean that's a really good point. I should have said that more clearly. Let me think of how I can make that more clear. Maybe I should just say, what I just meant is that, for example, my x data points, I'm not free to move those because those are like some properties of my data. I just meant these are fitting parameters that can be adjusted. But this is specifically how we'll adjust them in gradient descent. Yeah, but, yeah. I don't know if maybe you can think of a better way to explain this, but let me just say they're free parameters. I just meant that they're not inherent to the data. We don't change like the meaning of what we're exploring when we look at that. We kind of change how good the solution is. But again, this is specifically what we're using. Thanks for pointing that out. Okay. So I was going to start talking about k-nearest neighbors, but we only have like 4 minutes. So maybe I'm instead just going to kind of, because you guys have had a lot of good questions about gradient descent. So maybe I'll leave that. It's pretty short, but I'll leave that for next time. Let me maybe just emphasize what we're going to do in tutorial today. So in tutorial today, we're kind of putting together the three sort of major topics from the outline today. So the problem we're going to be studying is trying to do regression for this Ising model Hamiltonian. And the way that we're going to do that is with a linear regression algorithm. And we've seen that we can attempt to solve this linear regression setup directly by inverting this matrix, which can get big, or we can use gradient descent. So what we're going to do in the tutorial today is we're going to try solving this problem for the one-dimensional Ising model using both of those possible methods and kind of compare them. Does it make sense? You guys have questions about that?
So in this whole gradient descent discussion, we didn't discuss what L is, right? And what are we trying to minimize?
So that's another thing that I was trying to be general here, because L is also going to depend on maybe the specific algorithm. You can choose different things to minimize, but remember, going back to linear regression, it's always going to come from kind of in supervised learning, it's going to come from comparing the output of my algorithm with the labels in some way. Here it's just from taking like the difference and squaring. You could look at other options too for that. But again, if it's linear regression, you would just put in that formula, but it could be other things in other cases.
Like usual gradient descent, is there something that's usually used or?
Not necessarily. No, there's a lot of, this one is a pretty standard one that people often start with, but we're going to, in later lectures, talk about other options too. I think even within linear regression, you could use something else, although I guess this exact solution kind of relies on that form there. But
so it means like in the tutorial, what you're going to do is that when we're doing gradient descent, what L will we use? The same one?
Yeah. Specifically, we're not, gradient descent is kind of used together with another supervised learning algorithm. This is a gradient descent is a method for optimizing parameters, right? But we still have to have some way of defining what the supervised learning algorithm does. Here it does a linear transformation. So, and again, linear regression is special because we can have this exact solution. Next week we're going to look at cases where there's no exact solution. We have to use something like gradient descent because we can't just solve it exactly. But today, we are going to compare, because we can in linear regression, we're going to compare this direct solution with a gradient descent solution. Other questions? Let me just say about the tutorial, because you guys pointed out this conflict with philosophy of physics. So the tutorial for sure has to be today, because the TA is coming from Toronto. So I was just thinking about it during the lecture, what I could do. So I'm going to try to look into whether I can get anything adjusted for this conflict. So just maybe monitor your email if there's anything there. Yeah, so the thing is, I was explaining to people, I know it normally would have started at 2, and like 2 or 3 months ago, I got invited to give a talk this afternoon. And so I shifted it, but I think because philosophy of physics wasn't on the calendar until like a few days ago, like nobody noticed that this conflicts. So I need to do it then. I'm going to check. Maybe the TA can stay a bit later for those that come at 2. But let's say for those that can come, we'll for sure start at 1:30 because I have to leave by 3. But maybe I'm going to check to see if the TA can stay later. But just check your email. I'll update you guys on that. Anything else? Okay, great, guys. See you this afternoon then.